Please welcome to the stage Mr. Andy Serkis, Lee Pace, Orlando Bloom, Evangeline Lilly, she's coming, Richard Armitage, Peter Jackson, start off selfishly and rattle down the line if that's okay. Andy, we'll start with you if that's all right. You've been involved in both sides of this, of course, this whole journey of being behind the camera and in front of it. What are you going to take away from this experience and from being able to do both sides of this thing?
It really is. It's very much this whole journey for me has been extraordinary. Both as a working on a new technology. Again, this kind of goes back to where Pete comes from as a filmmaker and his desire to push the envelope and to turn, you know, reach a point in filmmaking where visual effects suddenly becomes character. So the whole performance capture journey has been extraordinary from that point of view. But then also to be asked to direct the second unit was an enormous shock, but it really speaks to Pete's understanding of and the way that he collaborates with all of the cast members and all of the crew, and as a natural leader and as a brilliant filmmaker. Overselling him, because he doesn't need selling really. But his virtues are that he is the most incredibly generous human being, and I think to learn from a director who's an incredibly generous human being, you couldn't ever want a better mentor.
I think
I'm
going to have to hire you again.
It's a deal.
Lee, you kind of steal the show with your horseback entry in this sort of thing. It kind of adds it kind of adds to his whole kind of presence and grandeur, doesn't it? It's that fun to kind of play with, to kind of even make him even more kind of powerful.
On set, that is basically you put on this blonde wig, put on this silver armor, and you get to sit here and. Okay, what's next? And he goes, you're going to ride an elk into a battle of five armies, and there'll be orcs here, and you know, just kind of go for it, swing your sword around. And then show up last night, and I watched the movie back, and it's just extraordinary. This, you know, battle is just massive, and somehow I find myself in it.
Orlando?
Yeah.
How are you, sir?
Hello.
It must have been an emotional journey for you, from being there across the kind of two epics.
Yeah, it is. It's been a crazy to think that I was 21 when I got cast and moved out to New Zealand. I'm 37 now, so it's a slightly new perspective. But yeah, it's bittersweet. I hope Pete feels a huge sense of achievement at this point, because I'm feeling a little bit of that. And very grateful to just have been on the ride, really.
Evangeline, what a character. She has no fear. She fears nothing. Would you agree?
I totally disagree. I think that she's terrified of everything and that she overcomes those fears and does it anyway.
She hides it brilliantly.
Oh, great.
You hide it.
That's what elves are supposed to do. They don't show anything on the outside. It's all inside.
Richard. What a journey he goes on in this film. Was that great to be able to take him kind of to those depths?
Yeah, I'm trying to get through this press tour without repeating the word journey or story arc, but really, Thorin has such an interesting story arc to play over three movies, and when does one ever get the opportunity to play a single story through three pieces? And, you know, the material is incredible, Tolkien is incredible, and this screenplay is absolutely fantastic. I was given some amazing dialogue to say, which I'm very, very grateful for.
Good answer, Richard.
Peter, sir, you said that you have a responsibility with these films and these characters, I guess, as well. How do you look on that responsibility now that it's kind of finished and you've delivered these stories?
I don't have the responsibility anymore. I can go to the beach.
As you can tell, he does that a lot.
But I mean, any film is a responsibility because you're spending, you know, you're spending money that's not yours, that, and you know, so you've got to be responsible for that. I also feel very responsible for the fact that you're trying to entertain people, and you know, and for me, utter failure is to make a film that people go to and they pay their money to go see and they don't like. And so, you know, from that point of view, I'm sure there are people that have seen these films that they don't like them. But the majority of people, certainly from what we can see, the majority of people have gone and enjoyed them, which is, for me, that's why we do what we do. To give people a good time at the movies. So,
yeah. Martin, hello.
What?
So rude.
No.
I've got to get down the line, speed it up a bit. Not many times an actor gets a chance to revisit a character on more than one occasion.
Yes.
What does that allow you to do then as an actor? Does it kind of allow you more freedom, or is it an easier or harder opportunity as an actor?
Well, it gives you the opportunity to actually grow and expand inside what you're doing. So I love to expand inside Bilbo over a course of 3 years. What? And
it's the truth.
And I'm only telling the truth, and now I'm being persecuted for it. And I think we know another man that happened to, don't we?
It's not the time or the place.
No, I'm just saying that within that, yeah, we all have a long time. I was going to be so good on this. We have a long time to play and discover things that our characters do. We don't just have 5 minutes. You have a long time to sort of play this, and if it's not your time to, because I was always having the conversation with Peter, when do I get to be angry? Like, when do I get to sort of show that different side? And he would always be saying, it's coming, you know, don't worry, pace yourself. Exactly. You have to shape it out, and what you learn is to pace yourself, and you learn to, you learn patience, basically. That time where you want to play that and you want to show that about that character, it will come. But you just have to wait, and it's yes.
Thank you. So Ian,
very good answer.
Thanks very much.
Are you finished, Martin?
Yep.
So Ian McKellen, do you think you'll ever say goodbye, farewell to Gandalf? I'll shout.
Well, you see, the thing is, no, I said goodbye to Gandalf in 2000 when I left New Zealand. Well, here we are, 2014. It goes on and on and on. And has been the blessing of my professional life. I'm like all of the actors. We think we're so bloody lucky. There's nothing about luck in the making of the films. Of course, that's the planning that brings. But the chance that we were selected, wonderfully, wonderful. But I was just impressed last night by the age of the kids who'd slept out all night to come and wish us well. And some of them weren't born in the last session when we started. Not born. So our work is part of their lives. And, you know, what are we doing it for? Other than to have an effect. And that the effect could be that crucial to them. And that they're now going to show these films to their own kids. To have been involved in films that are now classics is overwhelming. You can't take any credit for it, but it has just happened. And I just said, so in the end, it's not the end, it's the beginning now, as people see the film. And then we'll want to see the six of them. And that'll be a whole other new experience than none of us has been able to have until this last film it was made.
Thank you.
24 hours of joy. just to expand very slightly on something that Ian was saying, I mean, I was just thinking last night actually that we're about 3 or 4 years away from the generation that will see these films, the six movies, in the order that they should see them, in the story order rather than the order they were shot. Because, you know, children that are too young now, like 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old, too young to see these films in a few years, a very short time, they'll be able to start to see them, and hopefully they'll see them from the Hobbit 1 through to the Return of the King. So we're very soon, we're not going to have this sort of back to front thing. It'll be like it'll exist as a six film, story that it should be. So,
yeah. Is that what you planned from the start?
Well, not The Lord of the Rings, I didn't know I was going to do The Hobbit, but when we knew we were going to do The Hobbit, we were always thinking of the full arc of the story, because there's a lot of stuff in The Hobbit that we did, that we planted, which is designed to, you know, for the people that do finally see it in the correct order, it'll make sense.
Can I bring in Philippa, just the other side of screen? Hi, Philippa.
Hi.
I mean, all the foundations were here in terms of, you know, you kind of, with this, the films that had gone before this, but does that make it easier in terms of kind of knowing where the end point is for you, in terms of
having done the Lord of the Rings first, you mean?
Yeah.
Definitely. I think it was luck that we actually did, I think, those films first, because I think we would have made a very different Hobbit if we'd started with The Hobbit, probably more of a children's tale. And you know, not to say that that's would have been necessarily a bad thing, but we always knew, as Peter said, that these were going to be set against the backdrop of films that were already in existence. And what I do love now is that we've seen, for example, the relationship of Gandalf and Galadriel, and that she comes to save him. And so when she's told in Fellowship of the Ring that he has died, it's going to play in a completely different way. So that's the experience that I think is going to be special for those people who can see it in that order.
Thank you. Luke.
I am.
Bard the Bowman.
Bard the Lonely Bowman.
Everyone needs a Bowman to save them. Was it fun playing the hero?
Yeah. He wasn't a hero when I first read him on the page. He was just a lowly bargeman. I know what he was capable of and what he ends up doing in the third movie, but when I started playing him all those years ago, he was a father of three without a wife, and you know, he had a long journey ahead of him, but it was very satisfying last night to actually see the final the look of that rooftop sequence, which was the first thing I ever shot, wasn't it, Pete?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, he put me on wires and set me up the rooftop for 4 days.
There's a lot of scenes in this movie, this Battle of the Five Armies, that were shot 4 years ago, which is very strange.
Yeah. That was 4 years ago, I must have shot that. Yeah, so I waited a long time to see that scene.
Roy,
it's a very big bell, yeah.
Roy, what a great character you have in Alfred. He really helps to set the tone, I think, as well, throughout the film in terms of...
Yeah. The love of
the tone. Yeah, I wasn't going to say that, but in terms of... Did you really enjoy kind of, I guess, kind of bringing it to life? Did you get to play with kind of how where you took him, I guess, in terms of how that character...
Yeah, I think it was very clear on the page. So he jumped off the page to me from the first reading of it, but we got to play around. I mean, it was a good opportunity for Pete to play with me and bully me a bit and throw eggs at me. So it was great fun to be had with him, because he has a sort of foolish nature. He's a sort of dark, clownish character. So I enjoyed being able to find a little bit of me that's a fool and a bit of me that is vain.
Quite a lot in there, actually.
Thank you. And a bit of me that is sort of bitter and greedy and all those things, and exaggerate it and have fun being that person for a while. So it was a great treat to be him.
Thank you. Finally, Billy. Hello, sir. At the end. What a fitting end to this wonderful journey that you, with this song, The Last Goodbye. How did that come about?
I suppose, I don't know, really. I just know that I liked when I got the phone call, when I got the chance to go back to New Zealand and to work with Fran and Philippa so closely on writing the song. And it sort of organically happened, I suppose, because the song from Return of the King was in the trailer, and then we started talking about doing the song. And it sort of just sort of snowballed from there, you know?
Well, it was, apart from, you know, the fact that you've got a fantastic voice, it was also, we felt, just as an emotional thing, it was almost like a handover from the first three films to the second set of three films.
Yeah.
That Pippin sort of jumps in there to, you know, the beginning of his story, effectively.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about that when you were talking about watching it in the right order. You know?
Yeah.
But it was great. It was so good to be down there, you know, in a different way. When you're used to being an actor and you leave it, to be there at the sort of last couple of weeks and the excitement of putting it all together, you know, and getting to sit with Pete as he edited it was, you know, a real treat. It was great.
Thank you. All right, gentlemen over here, we'll start with you, sir.
Thank you very much. Hello, I'm Marcus from Germany. This is a question for Peter Jackson. Of course, next year we get the Blu-ray and the DVD of The Hobbit 3, but what happens after this? Is this really the end of Middle-earth, or do you see something in the books of Tolkien's where you would say this is worth to do another movie? I mean, we are in the century of franchise.
Well, we have the extended cut of the Battle of the Five Armies, which is going to be a fantastic extended cut. There's some really great stuff. So I go back to New Zealand in the new year. I'll be working for four or five months putting that together, which will be fun because it's all going to be actually some quite good stuff in it. So I'm looking forward to that. Then look at that point. It's a legal thing. The Tolkien estate owns the writings of Professor Tolkien. The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings were sold by Professor Tolkien in the late 60s, the film rights, but they are the only two works of his that have ever been sold as, you know, as potential films. And so without the cooperation of the Tolkien estate, there can't be more films.
Gentleman in the red t-shirt there.
Another question for Mr. Jackson. I was disappointed that I've not yet. I'm over here. Hi. Hello. I'm disappointed that I've not yet had a chance to see this in 48 frames, but I'm looking forward to that. How do you feel now about the whole high frame rate? I mean, I don't know if you call it an experiment. Do you think you'll continue working in that format?
Yeah, I mean, I just look. I just think that it's a much better way to see films, and after the first Hobbit movie, I went back into the grading room and I figured out a lot of little tricks to make it look less like the video thing. I know that people criticise it the first time around, and I sort of understood why when I... So when I did a lot of work, so the second and third Hobbit movies have got a slightly different look, and more of a texture, which I regret I didn't do in the first one, but it took a while to figure it out. But The way that I always answer that question, because it's a very fair question, is that to say that 100 years ago, you know, movies were black and white, they were silent, they were 16 frames a second, okay? And so 100 years from now, what are they going to be? I don't know, and we just do not know what form films are going to be in 100 years' time, but I think you can absolutely guarantee they're not going to be 24 frames a second, and they're not going to be 2D. So at what point between now and 100 years do these advances actually happen? So I just think it's, and ultimately, you know, the audiences for movies are beginning to dwindle. There's so much competition for seeing things on iPhones and iPads and everything else that it has become a very serious issue for the industry, because the industry has to have the audiences in order to make these films. It's to sort of feed itself. So it's become a very serious thing for the industry of how do you get people to leave their houses and go to the theatre. I mean, just the audiences are slipping away. So I think it's important that filmmakers do look at the technology that's available and just think of how we can use it to make that experience in the cinema a little bit more exciting. So that's my theory.
Thank you.
Hi. Good afternoon. This is Tina from Singapore. I'd like to ask the actors and the directors. So this has to be a journey of self-discovery. So for yourself, what have you discovered yourself as a person or as an actor through this journey?
Who's that to, sorry?
Sorry?
Who's that to? Who would you like to?
Just whoever who wish to answer.
Who would like to answer that one?
Self-discovery.
Martin.
I was going to ask you to be this person.
Oh, really? Yeah. Martin.
Madam.
Oh, really?
Yeah, go on, Martin.
I didn't find it really one of self-discovery particularly. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think that's kind of its own worth in a way. You know, I mean, we do things in life, whether they're jobs or personal things, that you just hope will give you enjoyment and, you know, enrichment in your life, and it certainly gave me that. I think I'm still too close to it yet to see how it's changed me, if it has changed me, or how it's informed me. I think maybe in 15 years I might know. I mean, genuinely though, very often you know things you learn in life you don't know 5 minutes later, you know them much later. So all I know is that I'm very, very glad I did it. I'm very grateful that it was able to work out. And yeah, I wouldn't have been without it in the last few years of my life, that's for sure.
Thank you. Lady in the front row.
Rachel, everyone, well done. The question is for Lee and Richard. Well, there's obviously a lot of male ego, love-hate relationship over there. Did it affect your on-set relationship in any way?
The male ego?
Yeah.
There's a lot of male ego on this table.
It's kind of built into the relationship. It's, you know, you've got two kings that represent two races, and so it's essential that there is this standoff between two characters, and it's set up in the second film. And even though the two characters don't really come face to face in the third piece of the jigsaw puzzle, you can really feel the tension between the elves and the dwarves, linchpin by these two potential kings, I think.
Your on-set relationship.
Yeah, I mean, we were pretty antagonistic. Every time the elf walked into the room, I would bristle.
Okay, we've got a gentleman with a microphone there.
Hi, this is Thiago from Brazil. So this is hashtag one last time. I would like to know from everybody, besides yourselves, besides Middle Earth, besides working with each other, what you're going to miss the most?
Can you direct that at a couple of people, please? Because we've got a lot of questions to get.
Peter Jackson, obviously.
No, well, I mean, I think you've answered the question in the truthfully. I mean, I'm going to miss the fun on the set. I mean, as Martin said, I kind of, making films is very, very hard. And if you're making three of them like this, 266 days of shooting, it could be bloody hell if it's not fun. And so I want to go to work in the morning and have fun. I want to enjoy myself. And fortunately, this cast is just such a fantastic cast, and they're all very, very funny people. And I just, outside of the fact that the cameras were rolling and we were all doing our part to create the movie, as soon as the cameras stopped rolling, it was just fun. It was an enjoyable way to spend the day. And I was certainly going to miss that.
Okay, if we get a microphone down the front row, and then we'll do some questions over this side, and then come back over in a sec.
Peter, mainly, and Ian, and anyone else on the panel that perhaps has children, I wondered, with J.R.R. Tolkien's writings, I'm sure most people in the room would agree that the books are brilliant. Do you think that there's still literature written for children today that's as good?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I think informed and influenced by him. And we have a children's book, well, wonderful children's book author sitting at this table, Evangeline Lilly.
Swicker
Wonkers, highly recommend it, who is venturing into that. The world of imagination, so.
Yeah.
Great, thank you. And if we can go to Jim in the hat in the front row, and then along to the blue coat.
Hello there. I've got a question for my 10-year-old son, Hag. It's to whoever's brave enough to answer it, really. There's now 6 movies. Which one's your favourite?
Oh.
I'd love to get all of you.
Fellowship.
Two Towers.
Fellowship of the Ring.
I think maybe Two Towers.
I think that's enough. Let's move on.
I like the Battle of Helm's Deep, actually. I mean, I like the Two Towers, but I like particularly the Helm's Deep sequence.
They're all brilliant.
Yeah. Can you pass the mic along, please? We'll do the lady and then the gentleman in the blue coat. Thank you.
Can I ask Peter, given your daytime immersion in fantasy, what do you dream about?
Fran Walsh.
Sorry?
It's a book, very boring answer, but every time I make a movie, and these movies were no exception, the first day I start shooting, I start having a recurring nightmare every single night that I'm lying in bed and there's a film crew surrounding the bed, waiting for me to tell them what to do, and I don't quite know what movie I'm actually making. And I'm not sure, I don't think there's even a script, and they're all standing there needing to have information from me, and I'm in bed, I'm tired, I'm exhausted, and I can barely think straight. So I'm sort of, and that nightmare, I mean, this is the truth, that nightmare starts on the clock on the first day of shooting, and it's every night till the last day of shooting, and then it stops. So it's hell, because I have all day on set, then I go sleep, and it's a full bloody night on set as well. So that's what I dream about, but it does stop. It's the day we stop shooting, it goes away, and then I have an ice cream.
Jeff,
with
the blue coat, please. Thank you. We'll come back
Congratulations, guys. It was a beautiful movie, and I can't wait to show my children. And I, it's unprofessional of me to say, but I actually had a little cry. But in terms of the film, particularly the next generation seeing such powerful stories, and this is obviously cinematically telling Tolkien's story, I'm thinking about particularly, Martin, for yourself, do you feel a sense of pride that this is a story essentially about the little man, figuratively and literally, who's making a big impact on the world? And that's the message that's important to, in this day and age, pass on. You usually play a guy who's like the everyman, and how did you find putting yourself in this fantastical situation, because you weren't in the other one, so it's also new for you in your life as well.
I'm very proud of the films. I'm very proud of my participation. I'm proud on all our behalves, really. That's why I don't feel sad about this being the third one. I want people to see it and like it. I think the message is pretty straightforward. It's not the first story in the world that kind of had that sort of message in human history, but I think the reason it recurs is because it's strong, and it's also it's aspirational, because we want it to be true, but it is also true. Most actual heroes in the world are not 6'5" and look like Vikings. Most everyday heroes do not look like that. We all know that to be true. Hollywood doesn't always tell us that truth. That's why we think it's surprising that Bilbo could be a hero. Well, actually, most people that we've ever met who we would consider heroic or brave or inspirational don't look like Dolph Lundgren. Do you know what I mean? I mean, don't get me wrong, Dolph was a lovely fella.
They never ever do.
I think it's not the first sort of tale in human history that's told that, but I think it's one that's worth retelling. Yeah.
And when you go around New Zealand, where you find a war memorial to the dead in every village, that they're often represented by a statue, sometimes in concrete rather than marble, but it's always of some perfectly ordinary looking lad, isn't it? I find them extremely moving, and in Lord of the Rings, Frodo doesn't get back home, as most of those lads didn't. Mm. But Bilbo does. So in a sense, the Hobbit is a movie with a happy ending.
I've got to just say that this cast at the table here, they're responsible for allowing you to connect with their characters. And I just think it was such a wonderfully skillful to not allow the fact that you're a wizard or you're a hobbit or you're an elf or you're a dwarf to overwhelm the performance. That there was always, everyone here found the truth in the characters that they were playing, so you could connect with an elf or a dwarf or a hobbit, and it was fine. That was so important that these films had that. It was going to depend on the skill of the cast, and these guys were superb. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen at the back, and then we'll come back down the front, please.
Over here?
Over here at the back.
Yeah, sorry. Question to Peter Jackson and Andy Serkis. Question would be, Mr. Jackson, you've raised the bar several times as high as possible in doing the technical topic that you could do on screen. So after this is all over now, are you going to follow that path on, or doing maybe something completely different in the future, other films? And to Andy, you've grown yourself like a whole new career out of this experience. You raised the bar in motion capturing like no one else did. What are you going to do with it in the future?
Peter, do you want to go first?
I'm just trying to think of how I can help you. The thing is, raising the bar with technology is really you do it because you have to do it. It's not a chicken and egg thing, really, where you say, what's a great piece of technology we can develop, and then let's find a script that we can use it with. I mean, we had to, once we knew we were doing the Tolkien movies, we had to create battle scenes, and we had to write software, we had to create characters and creatures that didn't exist, and so the performance capture was developed. So really, the technology is always driven by the needs of the story that you're telling. If 17 years ago, instead of doing the Lord of the Rings, I was doing a drama in a fish and chip shop, then we wouldn't have developed performance capture, particularly on the, well, unless we wanted a cop to jump around on that things or something. But you know, so it's really, you start with the project, with the story, and you think, how the hell are we going to do it? And it's the, how the hell are we going to do it is a thing that actually pushes the technology along. Is that sort of an answer?
That mixed with fearlessness, which you have in spades. That mixed with fearlessness, which you have in spades.
It's computer artists. It's fantastic people that are clever. I mean, I can't even do an email. I'm an absolute idiot at computers. But fortunately, I have a wonderful artist that you know. I just say, now, how can we do this? And all these people, these very very clever people, do it. It's,
yeah, I mean, I think you know, performance capture is, it's got an incredible future, and it is a marriage of performance, but it's also this incredible artistry and also the heritage of artists too, and a culture. Because I realised, actually, coming back to the UK and working with other visual effects companies, in fact, Weta really have developed the most extraordinary, singular pipeline in terms of transferring an actor's performance into an avatar character. And that is something that can be learned all around the world now, to the degree. I mean, it is literally people who have, not only are they creating software and technology, but it's artistry. It's the way that the performances are interpolated and transferred from the you know, what is created on set. So, but I mean, Pete's quite right. I mean, for instance, just to answer your question personally, I mean, I'm directing Jungle Book at the moment, and you know, we're creating quadruped animals, literally. People have said, well, you can't possibly be, how can panthers and tigers and, you know, how can they possibly be played by humans? But in the same way that Small and Benedict doing this extraordinary job of giving life and soul and personality to, you know, 150-foot dragon, you know, we're trying to break through in terms of technology that will, or methodology rather, that will help us break through into finding the how we're going to anthropomorphize, how we can humanize these animal characters. So you find the tools that are necessary for each job.
It's interesting, Andy. You just talking about the technology, but the technology, you can create the technology to make these things happen, but it's the actor that provides the soul. You use the word soul, and the technology ain't going to provide the soul. That's where the performance capture captures the soul of the actor. That's what it's great at.
Well, I think that's why it is such an extraordinary combination, really, because it is like what the visual effects team do, the way that they amplify the likes of characters, you know, like Small or Gollum or all of those things, is what is revolutionary. It's that you do have that human connection, that you can sense the emotion, all of the choices that the actor makes on the set with the other actors, all of that that you could never previously have the other actors imagine, is there for free because it's real, it's happening, it's chemical and it's vibrant, and that is what is lifted and then transferred onto these avatar characters, and that's why it is a beautiful storytelling tool and a really liberating tool for 21st century acting.
Thank you. To translate, they won't tell you what they're doing next. It's a secret.
We'll go down the front end to the middle.
Question for Peter and Martin. How do you hope, Peter, the film as a whole, inspire children and today's generation? And Martin, how do you hope your character will inspire children?
Well, I mean, I hope I inspire children to make films. I mean, that's what my hope is, I guess, really. Obviously, you know, the films can inspire people in other ways, I guess. But, I'm sitting here today being the result of TV and films I saw as a kid. I mean, Thunderbirds, the King Kong, Ray Harryhausen's movies, they're the reason why I'm here, because they just kind of like, they excited me, they inspired me to just become obsessive about making films. And so I do certainly, you know, it would be a wonderful, wonderful thing if there were young kids today who were getting affected by our films in the same way. I mean, that would be I'd be extremely proud of those.
Yes, so would I. I mean, any effect you can have on an audience, or almost if it's good or bad, I mean, we'd rather have a good one. But any effect you can have on people is a plus. It's ultimately why we're doing it. It's why we're not doing it just in our bedrooms. You want to touch people. You want to communicate something in some way. I hope to inspire children to be obsessed over jewellery. never give it back to them.
Yes, hello. I'm Sweden. Actually, two questions for Mr. Jackson. and they both concern, yes, they both concern the character of Beon. You've chosen to play down his role in the final battle. Instead, you emphasize the fight between your warlords and Legolas and Toriel and that little bit, which obviously I can see why. There's a beautiful ending to that love story. There are great action scenes. But I'd like you to elaborate a bit on why you've chosen to, you know, take that part with the story. And second question concerns Beon as well. Last year, around this time in Berlin, I also asked you about Beon. Obviously, he's played by a Swedish actor.
I was interrogated. Yes. and now I'm going to pay the price.
Yeah, yes, yeah, that time you told me that he was going to get more time in this film.
Did I? No, I think somebody impersonated me must have said that. Like, somebody who looks exactly like me. Look, Beorn in the Book of the Hobbit, he plays a very, very similar role to what he does in the film. It's he's a character that shows up at the very end of the battle. I mean, he's in this particular section of the book, so it's not really that different to the book. But what I was referring to is we actually shot some additional scenes with Beorn that were not in the book, and that's what I would have been talking about a bit. No memory of it at all. But anyway, if I did say that, and the extended cut, which will probably be about 30 minutes long, is definitely going to have some additional bail stuff and amongst a lot of other things too.
That will make you smile then. Lady next to you in the orange jumper, please, and then the gentleman in front, please.
Hi guys, thanks for the film. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
My question's for Luke and possibly Ryan. I don't know if he wants to answer as well. Were you disappointed when you went for an audition for The Hobbit and you had to play humans other than a wizard or a little person or a dwarf?
Well, I knew what I was going up for, so there was no missing. I knew exactly I wasn't going to be up for a Hobbit or anybody else. I was up for one of the only humans. There's not many of us written in the book, so. I felt quite lucky in a way, especially when I saw the amount of hours they had to spend in the makeup chair every morning. I felt saving grace.
Yeah, not having to have the prosthetics is definitely an upside of not being a cool elf or something. But
would like a pointy hat though. I would like a pointy hat.
Ryan, you auditioned for a Hobbit.
I was originally cast as Frodo Baggins. That's true. I was a Hobbit originally.
Actually, you also auditioned for a dwarf.
I did, yeah.
Anybody didn't audition?
I did.
He tried to audition for an elf,
I did
too.
Several auditions. Ian doesn't know I was Gandalf for a while.
He actually was wonderful. Ryan came in. We'd seen his audition on tape. He'd made us laugh so hard. And he came in. And he bought us coffee, and then he said, "I'm going to test you on your talking knowledge." And we were like, "What is this boy doing? He's insane!" And he gave us a test, but he was very funny. And so when Drogo,
I was Drogo originally.
Yeah, you were Drogo.
I still have my
hit the cutting room floor, so to speak. Hit the script cutting room floor, I should say. We loved him so much that we just had to keep writing for you.
Brilliant. And gentlemen with the red microphone there.
Yes, Bruce Kirkland from the Toronto Sun Media in Canada.
You!
And a question for Peter, Sir Peter, and Sir Ian. Oh, wait a minute. Mr. Jackson and Sir Ian.
Sure,
he's
just
said. No, I know. He's teasing us now, so.
Question?
So, I can remember sitting up at Cannes many, many years ago and asking Mr. Jackson if he was afraid of screwing all of this up. And now, all these years later, we see that there's 6 films, and now I can't imagine The Lord of the Rings without the Hobbit trilogy as well. It's a package deal. It got through all of the machinations of legal problems, and now we have 6 films. So I would love to hear from 2 of the gentlemen who have been part of this, you from the beginning and Surian from the time that you first stepped on set, how you see the entire legacy of these films, not separately, but together. So Mr. McKellen, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I would have to repeat myself and say that Peter has made
a series of classic films. It's not a franchise. It's a series of stories that all link together. I'd just like to say something else because it seems to be underneath so many of the questions. What is it like to be in Middle Earth? And it's an understandable question because I felt it last night. Oh, I'd love to be there. And I said, well, hang about, I was there. but actually, I wasn't there. It was the characters that were there. And Middle Earth actually is in our hearts. But it is up there on the screen. And aren't we lucky to have been, more than anybody else, I think, more than the director who's looking at it through there or on his video screen, we are actually there. It is snow falling on our boots. It's grass under our feet and the wind blowing in our faces. And we're
and the occasional green screen.
Well, there's much less green screen, it seems to me, than people might suspect. We are actually there. Of course, everybody else wants to be there too, and that's why they ask questions. What was it like to be there? And of course, the next development, I hope, is that Peter's going to devise not more films, but a situation that you can all go to that is as much theatrical as cinematic, a living museum where you will actually have the experience, as you sometimes do in the greatest exhibitions of that sort in Hollywood. Go into that and be there.
But I can have a little break first, yeah, a private cinema holiday first. But I mean, I think you almost answered your own question in a way, because it's like, you know, look, fate steers weird things. I mean, the very first phone call we made about these projects, which was 17 years ago, when we talked about 17 years, it was 17 years, for a friend of mine called Harvey Weinstein, who we had a first deal with, and the pitch to Harvey was, if you can get us the rights to these books, we'd like to make The Hobbit as one film, and if it's successful, then we'd like to do The Lord of the Rings as two movies back to back and get some 6 months apart. That was the big grand plan, and now 17 years later, it's sort of become, you know, six movies, where we did the wrong way around. We did The Lord of the Rings first, then The Hobbit was going to be two movies, and it was three. It's all very weird, unpredictable, and there doesn't seem to be anything in control. It's just circumstances and fate push you around. But, you know, the one thing that I think I'm very proud of, and I say I think because I haven't actually seen them together at all, but I think that when people do see the six films as a series in the right order, that they'll sort of sense that there was some vague design behind it all. As sort of chaotic as it kind of actually was, in the sense of the orders all being, you know, changed around, that I hope that, because I, you know, all the time during, and The Hobbit was obviously the thing that was, that, because that's, those are the three that had to tie in with the earlier three, is, you know, we you know, all the time I was thinking that this is going to be a series of films.
And that was expressed to us as well. Yeah. I think one of the things when I sat down to, we were talking about Legolas coming in, it was a concern as to, you know, whether or not the fans, how they would feel about bringing characters in like Tarry or Legolas, who aren't in the books necessarily, but it was made very clear to me by Pete and by Fran that they wanted to explore the backstory to these characters and then tie them in to see that character, those characters move through and make them a connection point for the Lord of the Rings, and that was something in this movie that I think was made very clear and worked really well.
Okay, we've got time for one more question. I think someone's already got a microphone.
Hello. This is for Peter. I was wondering, with perhaps the rather overt allegorical import of this installment in particular, with regards to the unfolding international political picture, is it hard for that not to imbue or inform perhaps the editing, i.e. is it hard to shut the real world out and deal with themes like this?
That's quite a serious question. Well, you're adapting very wonderful books that were written a long, long time ago, and obviously, you know, the thing with current politics and applying them to anything like a movie or a book is that I think it's a test of the timelessness of the book. That, you know, if you think of The Hobbit, 1937, you know, World War II hadn't occurred yet, and so you go through that, Vietnam hadn't occurred. I mean, it, you know, and obviously, The Lord of the Rings took off in the States in the 60s because of the Vietnam War, that somehow the Americans at that time embraced that book, which was published in the 50s. Those three books, they embraced that because it spoke to them about the Vietnam War. So I think the actual test of it, of people describe things as being having a timeless quality, which I think is used in a very loose way a lot of times, but I think the real test of the timelessness of a story is exactly that. That you can look at the world that you are in at that given time and find things in the story that was written a long, long time ago that still is true. Which means that it's got very basic human truths in it. And we are humans, and we always have been for hundreds and thousands of years. And you know that is embedded in these stories. It's at the heart of them.
Before I let you go, so Ian, you talked about going to Middle Earth, and I guess the closest that you guys all had to a physical thing of that was New Zealand, and New Zealand being a huge character and part of this whole experience, the time that you spent there, the work that you've done there. If I could just come down the line from Billy at the end all the way down and ask you all to think of a word for you that sums up that experience of time that you spent in that part, in the kind of, I guess, the real Middle Earth. Billy, do you want to start?
Yeah, I will. I'll start with magical.
Why?
It was awesome in the sort of visual sense. Everything.
It's more than one word.
Awesome is one word.
Awesome's good. Awesome. Luke?
Memorable.
Well, hi, Lizzie. I'm lucky enough to live here, sorry.
You could still give us a word.
About New Zealand?
Yeah.
New Zealand. I'm going to say, as the Kiwis would say, it's magic.
So, Ian?
And they also say, God's own.
Martin?
Fantastic.
Home?
Pinot Noir.
I'm hijacking my answer for a minute. There are two journalists in the crowd that are freaking me out as a fan of the Lord of the Rings movies. We have Frodo in the second row right here. You see that guy? Is he not so much like Elijah Wood? And Mary in the back row. Stand up. The guy with the spiky hair. That's the comic one has doppelganger. Sorry, Oasis.
Family.
Inspiring.
Progressive.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm sorry we couldn't get through all your questions, and a huge round of applause for our incredible casting crew.